Welcome, 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 welcome to Launch and Learn. Hey, how you doing? Welcome to episode 7 of Launch and Learn. Wow, 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 here we go. Today we have Alfonso Roca on as a guest, who's been working in product management for almost 10 years now. So he's going to share about building a few companies, as well as working in product in general, how to get started, how to prioritize things, stuff like that. So I think you're really going to like it. Stick around.
Alfonso, welcome to Launch and Learn. Great to
have you. Thank you very much.
So since you are living in Tokyo, Japan, yeah. My question to you is, what are you eating for dinner today?
I love that question. Yeah, it's dinner, right? You guys are going to have lunch. I'll have dinner. And actually for dinner, I'm eating Japanese curry. Like Indian curry, but Japanese curry, which is not a very well-known part of Japanese cuisine, but it's major staple here. Everybody eats it, and it's very heavy, so I should probably not have it for dinner, but that's what I'm having.
Yeah. It tastes like Indian curry, or what's it like?
It's its own thing. It's more like of a brown spicy curry with a bunch of rice and fried chicken. So delicious. Heavy. So I'm meeting a friend later tonight. It's 5:30 here. So, and we're having that for dinner near his house.
Yeah. Or sometimes you can have the curry with like a katsu.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Curry rice. Like I loved it when I lived in Tokyo.
That's right. Nice. Right. So katsu, it's like fried pork and breaded pork. It's delicious. Yeah.
Exactly. All right, cool. Now we will come to this later, but you have done a lot of different companies, you worked in different places. But first of all, you know, what sort of first inclinations did you have that you wanted to become an entrepreneur at a young age?
So I grew up, or I had the luck to grow up in a family or with parents that always pushed me and my brother to be independent. For example, I remember things such as I worked when I was 15 years old at my family's business, which we had a restaurant. So I would take on the days that the cashier had free. Those were my days to work. And, you know, they paid me $25, or they told me they did. I don't even remember if that was the case. Too young to need money, really. But yeah, so I guess without even knowing, it was for me, I had the luck, I do have to say, that I knew that I will eventually need to start my business because that's how things were. And I guess I'm lucky in that way, right? Also, when I was 17, you know, my father pushed me, okay, no, you got to get to work. And I'm like, but dad, nobody in my college is working, you know? And he's like, well, good for them. I mean, good for you. You're going to have money. You're going to be the guy of your friends that has money. So I should say I am, even though I worked in for 13 years in Europe, I am Mexican from the border with San Diego, California. So we had that really American kind of way of thinking. So for me, it came naturally. I do have to say I feel blessed in that regard of the family that pushed me to do that.
And how did you get started in product management? What made you interested in that kind of side of things?
Right. So right around that time, actually, when I was 15 years old, and I'm sure you will remember too, when as kids, we saw the first Nokia phones, and we played Snake. I didn't even know what it was, what product management was. I knew I liked computers. I've always been a computer geek, I'd say. But when I grew up, I want to build this. I want to work in this. I didn't know what this was, but I knew it had to do with cell phones and games and, I guess, apps, which, you know, were still probably 10 years before the iPhone launched. Yeah. And so that's, let's say I follow that. I became a computer scientist or an engineer at university. And then my first time in my first job, actually a month and a half in, I came to a designer. This is a story that I'm very friendly with this designer still, but at the moment I thought he was a bit rude, but he told me, I came to him and I was like, hey man, listen, there's this cool new feature that this framework allows us to do. What if we do this and we do that? He just looked at me and he told me, of course, this was our engineer designer conversation, right? So the designer looks at me and he tells me, what are you talking about? That decision belongs to the product manager. And I'm like, sorry? He's like, yeah, that guy. He's the product manager of mobile apps. And I'm like, that's what I wanted to be all my life. That's what I went to school for, you know? Of course, they never teach you what product management is until you bump into it, at least in my experience. So starting there.
Coming from a computer science background, which means you may not have had this business or design combination. What was the most challenging for you, going from engineering into product management?
Right. So that's a great question, because the business side is what made me say, oh, that's what I always wanted to do. But I definitely had no knowledge about good product design, right? Back then, we didn't even call it product design. Well, I think it was just visual, right? And so learning that, learning frameworks, learning the restrictions of the technologies that I had to work with, and what a good design was. This was, the iPhone had not launched its App Store yet, or it kind of just started at that moment. So, the design back then was very like skeuomorphic, or even worse, Symbian. The Nokia phones that I used to love eventually were pretty obsolete UI. So learning all that and watching that transformation definitely was a risk. Now, if I had to choose one, I say that people management, or management by influence, which I'm sure we've all heard, right? And not knowing where to stop or where my responsibility, ends was kind of tricky.
So tell us about iMixme. What made you leave your product job to start a new company?
Right. So iMixme was my first company. I was at this my first company that I worked at, or as a PM. It was a social network, pretty successful social network in Spain. And after 3 years being a PM, I felt that I touched ceiling, or that I had reached my ceiling there in the company as a product manager, and that I wanted to try something else. And one of the founders of the company actually approached me and told me, hey, I see you like to do this and you like to do that. Listen, there is a project here, and we're looking people for a group to start. And I'm like, all right, what's the project? Let's talk about it. He came with the basic idea of a trading site, for a free bartering site. So you trade for free. And I found it interesting, and I said, all right, let's do this. I had to work hard on trying to see how to monetize that, which was one of the specialties or the things that I've had the luck to work a lot in. And, of course, making managing the entire team, making sure we hire the right people. And I was the CEO at that company, short-lived company, less than a year. But it was definitely an interesting experience.
And how did you go about building the product? So, I mean, did you follow the, let's say, agile lean processes? Hmm. Did you have some sort of, let's say, discovery work before you start? Like, did you do some prototyping? Mm-hmm. What was all the steps that you took there?
Yeah, I'd like to say that I did things by the book. And even though a lot of them were, we were very young, eager. We were, it was my first time as an actual CEO, something. I wanted to think about the business model, and I had to sit down and read contracts and sign things and with, with millionaires next to me. And I was just like a 25-year-old kid. But what we did do right was we did a lot of product. Let's say we tried to find our customer fit. Who would be willing to do this? Who would be willing to exchange a bicycle for a television for free? We had to interview a lot of people. We needed the demographic for many things, such as marketing, and specifically for interviews. So we definitely follow that. I was lucky enough that I had just read Lean Startup, which I guess is a book that changed a lot of the way most of us work. So I definitely was, you know, oh my God, we cannot have any vanity metrics. Let's see what our real actionable metrics are, and so on and so on. So yeah, in that sense, we tried our best. We were young. We made some mistakes. The company went bankrupt, and I'm happy to say it wasn't because of our mistakes as in product. It was something else, let's say.
So you kind of spoiled the ending there, but what was the story of iMixMe, like the people arc?
Right. So sorry about that. How it ends is it finishes with a company that's been bankrupt and myself with literally €0 in the bank account, which you learn a lot at that moment about yourself. I also started losing hair back then, but and that's the moment I trace it back to. But basically, and this is one of the biggest learnings, or the biggest learning I had, even despite all of the other things that I learned, was I was swimming with sharks. I was swimming with these, you know, I was working with these billionaires, literally not billionaires, but they're pretty much 100 millionaires, you know, people that have spend, you know, $20,000 in a dinner party, for example, which is pretty crazy. And they're just like, yeah. So what happened is that something that was very valuable to me as the company, you know, which was the company, maybe it wasn't the same for them. And what that ended up happening is, as a CEO, I was also looking for investment. It was one of my roles or one of the things I needed to do. We found a very good investment, but from an entrepreneur, a German entrepreneur living in Spain, and he would end up owning around 35% of the company, which for us, it was like, hey, it's either, you know, this guy is here, he's very smart, he has a lot of experience building, he had like 7 video game companies, like mobile app game companies. And so we wanted to bring him in, and one of the main investors, the capitalist investor, said, I'm not willing to sell that amount. And we couldn't really negotiate. He kind of locked the whole thing, and we had, I don't know, 4 more months of runway, let's say. And we finished the runway, and we crashed or went off. Yeah. Company had to close. I had invested also all my money at the moment, which wasn't much, and that's it.
So, like you said, the company went bankrupt, and you also lost a lot of money. I'm sure that was a bit of a watershed moment for you.
Yeah.
How did you handle that, and what was that process like to figure out what's next?
Yeah, rely on your friends, they say, right? So I went back to Madrid, where I lived. I stayed at a friend's house for 2 weeks at his couch. I got a bank loan, which, you know, I'm lucky that I paid it off, but not the most exciting thing to do in your life. But I got a bank loan, and that would help me get like through the next 6 months. And I was lucky enough to get a job at a very nice company. So let's say the cycle just started again. And so I started as a product manager with more experience this time in another company. And I feel very lucky about that too.
And then going from that product management experience, I think, like you said, you went through the cycle again. So
yeah,
that part started your next company.
That's right. Yeah.
So what is this company Week of? And, you know, what's the story behind how you started that company?
Right. So Wego was started with colleagues from the first company that I mentioned, the social network. And basically what happened is we were all, you know, a bit music lovers. I also play bass, and we were chatting about how a concert, I don't remember which concert, but that we both wanted to go, but we didn't end up going because we didn't know anybody that was interested in that band specifically. You know, the typical really obscure bands that you love and nobody else knows, kind of like that band. And we were like shocked, and we were like, hey, we should make a website that does this. So we embarked our way into building what at that moment we called Tinder for Concerts, because it was a really catchy name. It wasn't really meant for dating, but it was more like connect Wego to your Spotify account. We'll track what you're listening to. And whenever one of your bands are coming to town, we'll let you know. And we're letting you know, but as well, we're letting everybody in your city know. And you can see who is actually interested in going. You can chat with them. You can do that. And for this, we did it. I'm happy to say I learned from my mistakes in my first company. And we started on a very scientific, way of doing things from the beginning. Of course, following also, lean strategies, agile methodologies, and so on.
What was the first version of the product and how did it kind of evolve as after you launched?
Yeah, the first version of the product, we did a lot of online interviews. We were actually paying Facebook ads and Google ads to answer a survey that we had. And that helped us answer some crucial questions. For example, one of the crucial questions we had was, are people willing to go to concert with strangers? Which we thought, no way, that's dangerous. And more than half of the people, more than 50% of the people answered, yeah, why not? We had many options, but most people said yes. And most people said yes if I can have contact, if I know the person or like kind of know the person. So the first product was very focused on managing your music and on chat. So we built like a chat service. We would tell you if you had Facebook friends in common and so on, so it could be more friendly. So we tried to tackle those two things first. First, so because we consider that the core, right? So we tackled, okay, we will track your music and we will allow you to talk to people. And then a third part, which was more on our side, the concerts, of course. So we started, it was a pretty much an API aggregator with a chat. So it was the Spotify API and all the tickets API with an integrated chat. Let's say that's the first version. Yeah. The second version, I guess, would you like to know?
It would be good to hear the iteration from the first to second version. Yeah.
Yeah. The second version. So by that time, we were already a team of around 9 people. We were growing fast at a very good pace, and the investors were good. They were putting money on the table, but we definitely needed to start making money. We were selling somebody else's tickets, right? For example, let's say Madonna. You would come to Madrid and you could see Madonna in concert, but we would get 1% to 0.9% per ticket, which is very low. So the second version was we hired Salesforce and we started being a ticketing platform ourselves. So we started offering that service to bands. We started, sponsoring concerts. We had our own like festival. We had all that. So that way we would sell a ticket for a band, and instead of getting 1%, we would get 10%, which is still not fantastic, but it's, 10 times as much. So we could definitely build a business out of that. And the second part was very focused on that, on trying to make money and grow a scalable business that in general makes sense.
And how do you come to that conclusion that that direction was the right one? I mean, do you have some sort of process before that?
It was, so we knew that we were making money with the way we were selling tickets back then. We started seeing that was the main part, the main feature, let's say, that brought our users. We actually started seeing that the chat, even though it had activity, our ticketing screens or web pages had way more traffic than that. So we started seeing that what users wanted was a friendly interface that they can see who's coming to, who's playing, or they normally already know their bands. we started seeing that it's crazy, but we started meeting our power users. We did a lot of interviews with them. And I'm not joking. There's people that would go to maybe 5 concerts a week, which I was like, whoa, I was very impressed by that. There were people that were going to 2 concerts per day. I didn't even know you could do that. So we definitely started focusing on those users, right? And because they clearly bought a lot of money, spend a lot of money in tickets. Coming from that, we said, okay, let's start focusing more on the ticketing platform now. And how can we make some more money on this? And the natural evolution was we need to be the organizers of the concerts. We need to be the ones that are paying, you know, the bands to create their concerts. And let's forget a little bit just about the chat and all those things. They're just add-ons rather than a business driver.
So was your team all in Spain? Your product team?
Yes.
To scale that, how did you scale that?
It was all in Spain. In my first company, I really liked that my team was remote, and that's something that I've tried to do in everywhere I go ever since. But at that moment, we did have the entire team in Spain, and the development team was quite small. We were around 5 people when I left, which I'll tell you about it now. And the largest team was the sales team. So, for example, growing the sales team is, in my opinion, a bit easier because normally each agent has or knows their people. You know, oh, this guy is, or this lady is an expert in this region of the country. And so there you go. Plus, then normally the contracts are a base salary plus a percentage of the businesses that you bring in house. So it's pretty clear and it's easy to get motivated, and it's not as expensive as for the company. On the engineering side, we had to do a lot of interviews, hire the right people. It costed us a lot of time to get, for example, our first CTO or the CTO, our first and only CTO. And because we wanted the right person, you know, that knows architecture, that understands the product. He was actually a jazz piano player as well on his free time. So he fit perfectly, you know. And now we didn't have a very specific growth strategy. Because our objective was solely one, which was scalability, which that's the problem that we had. So we identified the problem and we hired the people to fix it and maintain it. So that was the CTO and backend engineers was then, but I would call one of them now a site reliability engineer, and another one was kind of an architect as well.
You said that you preferred remote teams, actually, which is interesting. I mean, I think a lot of people are having to work remotely now. Yeah. Why did you appreciate having a remote team? And what would you say to people now that are having to work more remotely?
Yeah, my number one argument, or not mine, but the argument that is brought to me is like, well, what if they don't work from home? And my argument is, why would you hire people that would not work from home, you know? If they're not supervised or something like that. So, and I do it more, I like working remotely more because of what I get from it. I like to, for example, I like to travel, and I've worked at companies where I could go to visit my mother for 1 month entire, and I have no problem. To be honest, people end up working more hours, or that's at least in my experience. Which, you know, I would not say that's a perk. It's just an observation. But I think that it's okay to be in person when it's needed. But when it's not, this is enough, right? A video call, a conference, working asynchronously on documents. And I think in the end, you end up hiring, you know, people that are more, well, maybe... This is not the case, but I like to think they're more responsible. At least I like to think so. Now, I do have to say that I've worked at a 100% remote company, which was Bitcoin.com. And I was the person that was actually pushing for at least 1 month in the headquarters per year policy. So because I do think that, you know, it's important to go and have dinner together. It's important to go and have beers, talk about your family, about what you like to do, which is normally avoided in a purely remote company. So you also need to pay attention to that, I think.
So what tips would you give to a company that is now working remotely to keep that kind of culture going of just chatting and being community oriented?
So trust your people. And if you see something that doesn't work or someone who is just not working well, act on it. You know, try to motivate that person and all that. There are a few, I mean, talking about companies, make sure that people have everything they need to work from home. And for example, you might need to give some money for them to get a desk or some kind of expenses like a second screen, which we normally don't have at home. And then on the human resources side, you need to be very, you know, on point to understand, you know, things that are like goals. Have we set any goals? Have we set anything like that? You know, you need to be more precise and more, you know, communicative, so to say, on your processes, right? And then something, this is my number one recommendation for everybody that's working from home. It's don't eat where you work. Have two tables, one to eat lunch and one to work. And you do not do either one of those things in the other table. That's what has helped me the most, to be honest. It's crazy, but right now I'm in my work desk and it's all work. I have like my journal here, my screen, and over there. And over there is my lunch table. And it's very important because this is my office. And then I go to out of the office. And when I go out of the office, I'm not working, right? I might be checking my phone. I might, you know, respond to a Slack message, but I'm off hours at that moment. And it's important to have off hours when you're working from home, I think.
It's quite difficult to have two tables in Tokyo in an apartment. I didn't have the space. Going back to week of, you mentioned the issues of scalability. I think that's definitely a big point. You know, once you start getting traction, like how do you make sure that you focus on the right things at this point in time?
Yeah, right. So you know, prioritization is super important, and I think the trick for a correct prioritization is impact, right? So if you're building something and it's not causing any impact, why are you building it, right? So it can be, for example, sometimes we think, well, a backend fix might not have a lot of impact. Well, you know, if it affects speed, it does have a lot of impact. Or if it allows you to build things on top of that, eventually, it does bring a lot of impact to the table. So the number one thing is impact as a North Star, let's say. And then once you try to ground that, there are exercises around there that are easy to do where you need to, you know, get into an agreement of, as a product manager, right? To get everyone into an agreement that A is more important than B and B is more important than C. And that's sometimes hard. Because, you know, egos can get hurt, which I wish you that not many egos exist in your company. But what I like to do is use an exercise such as, you know, the measuring impact, effort, and priority that allows me to take something as, you know, non-existent as an opinion into something measurable, like a number, like a judgment decision. So basically it's passing from qualitative to quantitative, right? It's not the same if I say, well, that's the most important thing for me versus me saying, well, for me, that's a 4 out of 5. And you're like, okay, well, you know, And then you can start working with that. And that plus getting a lot of people in the room, that helps me put up, you know, make sure everybody in the room is in the same page. So, for example, that's where, in my case, in that case of the scalability that I mentioned earlier, I was saying, guys, this is a 5, which was the highest, right? And in that moment, where the sales team could not sell more tickets because sometimes the site was down, or, you know, or in general, let's say everybody said like, yes, it is a 5. So, okay, I'm happy at least we could go get that. Now, next, what's this? Is this a 4 or 3? Da, da, da. So, you know, that using tools such as that is my recommendation. And then ideas can come from any place in the company. Nobody has the exclusivity of, you know, the monopoly of good ideas, as one of my bosses used to say.
I can imagine it's pretty cool to build a product that becomes scalable and grows, you know, being used all across the country and even in multiple countries. But how did your involvement with WeGo end? And
right,
how long were you there for? Yeah.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to exit WeGo. I'm not a millionaire, but it was, you know, we sold it to a ticketing company. And now why, right? It was pretty early. Well, it was like on year 2 or 3 since that first chat we had with my fellow coworker, where we said, let's build this. Basically, what happened is that we started eating revenue out of a very large company in Spain that also does ticketing. So they pretty much came to us with an offer we could not refuse. The way I saw it is, I was in here for the let's say technology side of it. We were planning some really cool things. We were doing, for example, you know, in concerts you lose phone reception. So we were planning, hey, what if we could do like a mesh network Bluetooth chat for concerts, you know? And, you know, you don't need, if you want to message your friends, which you can't because there is no internet normally because the cells collapse, you can do it on our app. And that's just a continuation of the normal chat. But we got to a point where we were running out of money. The team was pretty large. We were still making money, but we were definitely on that curve where we, you know, just needed to push a little bit more. But we were not sure what was going to happen. And for me at that moment, what it seemed like was like, hey, here's a really good offer. The business of WeGo is the ticketing side of it. And that's what this company is going to buy. The brand is going to live forever, or I mean, it's going to keep existing, which was one of the things that we agreed on. And most importantly, the 17 employees that we had by that time were going to, you know, continue working on, you know, could focus on years down the road, you know. Of course, we didn't tell them, hey, you know, money's scarce. Money's always scarce in startups, but it felt for me like a good way to move on, you know. Also, of course, we also, that also included me working with them and advising on some stuff. So I was still very much involved in after the sale. So that's how I left it. Yeah.
In the product management, since you now have been over a decade in product management, so you're kind of an expert there. Do you have a set of frameworks and tools that you like to use in sort of day to day?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, one thing that is true is that the tool set depends a lot on the industry and on the technologies, I'd like to think that you say. Of course, there is things, you know, like in, you know, interviewing your users will always give you a feedback, or your clients will always be crucial and essential to discover what you need to build. Are you covering my user, my pain points? I have been very influenced by Lean Startup, I do have to say. I haven't read any other book that has impacted me in such a strong way. So I do like to think, like in the Lean Startup way, of try to get the most impact with the least investment. So I do believe in doing things, you know, that might not be, and that might be a little bit quick and dirty if it's my own company. On the more corporate side, you know, maybe you cannot do those kind of things. So you need to structure a way to gather feedback differently. Perhaps, you know, Net Promoter Score, right? That's why I think that's why Net Promoter Score is so widely used among corporate, super mega corporate entities, because it's literally one question and the answer is 0 to 10 or 1 to 10. So, and that's it, you know? So I think you need to manage things. I love doing A/B testing. Honestly, I don't do it as much as I'd like to, because it's never easy. Normally you need to build you get to a project and normally there's no infrastructure to do A/B testing. So I like to do that. Of course, I rely heavily on numbers. Statistics is key for me. A lot of intuition too, or for experience. You know, I've seen this before, so I think we should probably do this based on the data as well. So I'm pretty number centric, of course. And then numbers don't tell the whole story, so interview your client, your people on the user side, not on the client side. That's what I normally like to do. And read books. If you don't know something, read a book. And that's what I like to do too. Read an article, listen to a podcast, right? Something like that.
I gotta agree that I think product's a pretty good choice for career, and I think it's a really interesting industry. Yeah. But what advice would you give for someone who wants to get into that field? Because I think it's not something you can necessarily study in school or something like that. How would you
Right. Want
someone to get into that kind of?
So if the person that wants to get into PM is already working at a technological company or a company that has PMs, maybe pharma, I know they have PMs too, even like accessories, is to ask for an opportunity. I think we're lucky in our field, you know, more technology wise or online software, online services, where it's pretty laid back and casual, and asking for an opportunity at a role might not be frowned upon. It might even be seen as a good thing. As to shadow a PM that you admire, ask questions. I ask a lot of questions that people might be embarrassed to ask. And, you know, if you say it with a straight face and like, yeah, man, this is just, you know, there's people are like, wow, okay, yeah, this guy asked the right questions, you know, especially if you don't know what you're doing, ask things like, what are your expectations of me? Right. Things like that. I would tell that to somebody that's starting and gets their first opportunity. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'll do that. But can you tell me, what does it look like? How does it, what do you expect from me? Have you done this before? And try to learn the ropes. That's how I learned to write my first PRD, for example. They told me, write your first, you need to write a PRD for this. And I'm like, a PR what? Yeah, can you share one with me? Because I have no idea how it looks like. Oh, there. Yeah, there you go. Oh, okay, I can do this. No, start with that. And now, like you did say before, there were not product management schools, but now I've seen a couple of online product schools, which, mm-hmm. you know, go over the basics. Even in places like Udemy, there are some things that can start. And that would be my recommendation. Start lean and read Lean Startup.
Yeah, talk about Udemy. I have a course there. Actually, no, just cut that.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate having you.
Thank you very much. I'm a follower.
Where can our listeners connect with you online?
People can look for my name on LinkedIn and reach out to me there. And yeah, we can have a chat there. No, feel free to message me.
And did you bring a quote today that you want to share?
I did bring a quote today. I don't know if you will agree, but Reid Hoffman, LinkedIn founder, said, if you're not embarrassed by your product, you launch too late.
I've heard that too before, yeah.
Yeah. And I like that a lot, and it says a lot. I've seen companies fail because they launch too late. Companies, friends, companies. Yeah.
Sounds like definitely a lean MVP principle.
Absolutely.
For sure. Cool. Yeah, thank you so much for your time, Alfonso.
Matthias, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for listening. We really hope you enjoyed it. Our captivating theme song is The Vendetta by Stefan Kartenberg. If you want to connect with us or send a guest recommendation, drop us a line at launch.learn@gmail.com or connect with Matthias or myself on LinkedIn. Have a great one and see you next time on Launch and Learn.
Have a good day.